Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. There are just three things I ask of you, if appropriate to you and your experience. Please subscribe, please click on the like button, and please share this program link with any family members, friends, or colleagues who might be interested or benefit from the content. Now, on with our program.
This is Mike Consul. Thank you for joining us. So you have gotten a book published. You've gone the traditional route. You got an agent you like a whole lot. That agent connected you with a publishing house with a terrific editor. And the book, they're excited about your book, and they put some muscle behind it. And by and large, the book is selling. And it's selling in some decent numbers. Well, what's the next step if you're a published author? You start to think in terms of, maybe this book can sell overseas. Maybe this book should be translated into 12 or 20 different languages so that people around the world can also enjoy my brilliance and my storytelling and so on. So today we're going to talk to a translation expert about a host of questions that revolve around that whole subject area. I mean, haven't we all picked up a book where we've seen that it's been translated into 26 different languages, or I think the biggest number I've seen is 40 different languages. And that's really exciting. But why do these books get picked? What languages are the first ones in line? What about makes a good and bad translation? There's a whole host of questions around that. We're going to talk to one of my favorite women in the world. Her name is Christina Della Torre. And the reason she's one of my favorite in the world is we met in Paris many years ago. We were in the Bastille district. She was with her daughter, Alex. I was with my wife. And we happened to be staying in the same boutique hotel, again, in the Bastille district. And she did something that I do all the time. She started talking to a stranger. It's the best way to live your life. Just talk to strangers. And my wife had been asking a question at that front desk. And when she overheard that and overheard the answer, Christina just jumped in, and we were off and talking. And we not only ended up going to a museum together that day and having a repast together, we hung out for days in Paris. And when you meet a woman in Paris, that's a special thing. This was complete serendipity. And what ended up happening is, 25, 30 years later, we are still good friends. And she's also one of the smartest people I know, former professor at Emory University. And I'll get into that more. But first, I want to welcome Christina Della Torre to the program. Christina, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for bringing up that memory. It's one, a very, very nice one. And you were actually very easy to talk to. You required absolutely no effort. You collaborated from the start.
Yeah, I talk a little too much sometimes. So people have, my mom used to always say, I can't even get a word in edgewise with you. but fortunately, it was quite well balanced, I think, because everybody liked to talk, and the repartee was very good. So for our listeners, before we get into this, Christina Della Torre has been translating words and cultures since she came to live in the United States as a child. Later, she married a German. And I know this German. His name is Erdmann. What a character Erdmann is. Another brilliant man, another brilliant person, also a professor at Emory University. Now, they're both retired since then. But you talk about a fire and ice relationship. Christina, the Cuban, Erdmann, the German, they go together so well. Now, Christina taught Spanish while she was at Emory University in Atlanta, also known as Coca-Cola University, because it has drawn so much money from Atlanta-based Coca-Cola. And for many years, she had a successful track record in translation courses in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese. And Christina, you have said that the proudest work, correct me if I'm wrong, but the proudest work you've done at Emory, and maybe outside of Emory, is your translation work.
It just thrills me. It is my passion. It is the thing that really truly satisfies me. I mean, there are a lot of other things satisfying about my teaching career, but this was one of the special ones. And I retired early in order to devote more time to translation, interpreting, etc. It is just a joy.
Well, tell us why, what is it about translation that is so gratifying to you?
Well, so many things, but, and this speaks to writers, it has the thrill of writing without the anxiety of creation. You have, you're working with a text already, the plot, the characters, everything is worked out for you. You focus on words and expressions and tone and rhythm. And that is just really kind of a Zen endeavor for me. It's the one thing I can get utterly lost in. Occasionally, I would get stuck and just go to bed kind of distressed. And actually, I realized how much work is done overnight, because I would wake up and jump out of bed with a solution and run downstairs to the computer at 7 in the morning. And the next time I looked up, it was 3 in the afternoon. I was still in my pajamas. I had not had anything but coffee. And it's just that kind of liberation, that all-encompassing involvement that is so thrilling to me.
Wow. And, you know, we've talked a few different times on a Novelist Spotlight about the work that gets done during the night, just the subconscious mind going to work, and then we wake up with a solution. That's just a beautiful thing. Let's talk about what books get picked for translation. Why do books get, I mean, we know why they get translated, but what books actually get selected for translation? What are some of the characteristics they have to have for that?
Well, actually, going back to your introduction, it is not actually the author most of the time that says, oh, I want to be translated. It is the publisher who says, oh, I think this book might be a good sell. So it is the publisher that usually holds the rights and usually promotes the translation. I know how they do it in Spain. In Spain, because I participate in it, the Ministry of Culture every year picks out or asks the publishers to send them books that they think would be good for translation. And then the Embassy of Spain in the United States distributes them for the English version, distributes them to a group of people, a group of experts. And they evaluate these books on their merit, on their literary merit, on their sellability, on their marketability, and any number of other things. And then the Spanish Cultural Ministry takes it from there and determines 10 will be funded for translation. So that's how Spain does it.
So they're obviously looking to countries that they think this is going to have appeal in those countries. Let's take a look at, say, English language books here in the United States. What are the first few languages a translation that they would target for translation?
Oh, number one, the United States is notorious for lagging behind in translating any books. I think it's about 3% of published books that are translated. In fact, there's a website called 3% that deals with all these translation issues. And I think that is due to our cultural superiority, the fact that, you know, we'd rather just stay within our familiar bounds. I think this is changing now that people travel so much more. But going back to your question, there's no doubt that French and German are the ones that are translated more frequently.
And why is that the case?
Well, because we admire French culture and German culture for different reasons. And that's where we go to expand our horizons, so to speak. And those are countries to which a lot of people have gone. And so they're initially familiar with them. They have studied a little German. They have studied a little French. So there's some familiarity already built in there.
Today, in English is very much based on Germanic and French languages, right? I mean, there's an awful lot of words in the English language that are based on French and German Or am I wrong about that?
There's any number of cognates, obviously, in both French and German. All the long words in English have Latin roots. So all the
like conflagration.
Exactly. All of those have Latin roots. So there you have just a basis to begin with. And some people, I was reading a book by a woman called Lydia Davis, who is an eminent translator and writer. It just came out. And she says that she started trying to learn Spanish by reading, which I found really unusual, by reading The Adventures of Tom Sawyer in translated into Spanish, which I find peculiar to try to teach yourself a language with a translated book. But she decided to read it without a dictionary, and just found all sorts of connections with cognates and derivative words, etc., that helped her. And she's brilliant, but she finally made it through and is very happy about her Spanish.
Now, I would imagine that it's not inexpensive to translate books. So I'm wondering if American publishing houses are being that they are always concerned about profitability and holding down costs, that do you think that that's part of the reason that only 3% of books get translated?
No, not really, because translating pays very badly. Literary translating pays very badly. It's a side gig for most of us. There's two wonderful organizations: the American Literary Translators Association, ALTA, which specializes in literature, and then there's the ATA, which is more wide-ranging professional. Covers everything, the American Translators Association. And a lot of us have to say that it's just a side gig, because we cannot live from this unless you are a star like Edith Grossman, who recently retranslated Don Quixote, for example. Then she might be able to live from the proceeds of translation. But otherwise, it's a labor of love and obsession.
What about the, a book will get translated and then it will get translated again in the same language? I mean, there'll be a second Spanish translation. And I've heard people be critical of, and I wanted to get into this with you, although I was planning to do this a little bit later, just, you know, there's good translation and bad translation. Are books sometimes translated into the same language again because it was badly translated the first time? What's with that?
Not usually. There are any number of translations of books, obviously. I mean, Don Quixote, the classics are translated every once in a while. Proust, In Search for Lost Time, a little bit less because it is 4,000 pages. But so many of the classics are translated frequently, and that is because somehow for every age, you need to update it. And of course, you need to update it. For example, if you have an expression in Spanish, por Dios, in the 18th century, you might translate it by Jove. In the 19th century, you might say, good grief. And today you might say, no way. So let's see why you have to go back and kind of update the translation.
Languages are living, breathing organisms, you know.
Absolutely.
They continue to evolve.
Yeah.
So you mentioned... Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, you mentioned French, the France and or French and German. The French are Epicureans. We always appreciate their Epicurean lifestyle. They truly know how to live. Nobody just ask a Frenchman or Frenchwoman, and they'll tell you. And then we appreciate German engineering and beer and so on. But what about beyond that? What would be third, fourth, fifth in line, just in terms, maybe regions of the world or other languages that come after French and German for translations most often into those languages?
Well, into English, the Spanish literature from Latin America and from Spain as well was mostly ignored until the 60s, when what is known as El Boom happened, And El Boom was the result of a translator, Gregory Rabassa, who was absolutely magnificent. He translated 100 Years of Solitude from García Márquez, and that kind of exploded, and it opened up the market for Latin American literature in a way that had not happened before. This was in the 60s, and Latin American literature has had a market ever since. And now there's also a market for Latino literature in the United States. So it all goes very slow, but it was Rabassa translating 100 Years of Solitude that made the Latin American book market explode. About other countries today, as a matter of fact, on the inside cover of the New York Times, there was a list of 8 recent books in translation. For people who are thinking about travel, blah, blah, blah. And there were books from Morocco, from Egypt, from Saudi Arabia, from Korea, from Russia, one from Spain. That was 6, so I don't know what the other 2 were. So you see, it is kind of floating out there and growing in people's perception.
So let's take Gabriel García Márquez. I mean, he's an excellent example. His writing is beautiful. And, I actually prefer Love in the Time of Cholera myself. Is it possible to take a book in one language and make it as beautiful or well-written or even improve on it by translating, or is something always lost in translation?
That is part of the problem with translation. Those were Frost's words. Poetry is what is lost in translation. Somehow translation has had very bad PR from there. And the Italian saying, traduttore, traditore, translator, betrayer, etc. Yes, in fact, García Márquez himself, being the kind person he was, stated that he liked himself more in English than in Spanish. It is entirely possible to come up with a version that is as wonderful. It will be different, obviously. One of the best translators from Spanish and my personal mentor, Margaret Sayers-Pedden, who was, among others, Isabel Allende's translators, likened the process of translation to an ice cube, letting the original ice cube melt and freezing it in a different form, reconstructing it from the element into a different form.
You know, you mentioned Isabel Allende, and I saw her speak one time in Portland, Oregon. I remember that she said that her mother always reads her writing. She gives the transcript to her mother as she's working through the transcript, I think, you know, chapter by chapter. And her mother is her first editor. And somebody in the audience stood up and asked the question, well, what happens when your mother is no longer with us? And she said, well, I guess I'll be writing shitty books by that time. What is the largest number of translations? I mean, if you, what book or how many different languages is the most you've ever heard of a book being translated into?
Oh, that is a very easy question. I'll give you one guess. It's the Bible, of course. And it has been translated into something beyond 3,300 languages.
So, but that's not fair, because it's a religious text. What about a literary text?
You'll be surprised. I looked this up, thanks to your questions, but I looked this up. I Googled this. Uh-huh. And you'll be surprised by what the second and third texts to have been the most translated are. The second one is The Little Prince. And the third one is Pinocchio. The Little Prince has been translated into 380 languages and Pinocchio into something like 260. So a lot of children's books are in the top ranks of the most translated.
That makes sense. I can imagine that. That's it makes sense. So do authors become involved in translations at all, or is it strictly, or are they not part of the process?
Well, a lot of authors do translation, and in fact, say that that is part of the of their writing process is translation. In fact, Javier Marías, a very well-known Spanish author, says that if that is the first thing he tells anybody who asks him for tips on writing, he says, go and translate somebody you admire. As far as how deeply they are involved in the process depends a lot on whether they know the language or not. I've had some interesting experiences translating living writers. And at some point I decided that my next project would be a dead writer so that there's no chance for back and forth. I translated, for example, a novel that was originally written in Catalan, and she herself translated it into Spanish, and then she put it in a drawer for 10 years. The two versions, the Catalan and the Spanish, since she translated it herself into Spanish, were quite different. And I talked to her and I said, so which version do you want me to work with? And she said, oh, Cristina, just, you know, do whatever you want. Just take the one you think it's best and weave it together. And I was very happy for that attitude. She was very helpful. But I hit a moment of panic thinking, just watch the critics compare my translation to one of these versions and say, where did this chick get this word from? It was a very sobering thought, but it didn't happen. But the versions were rather different in so many ways. Of course, she had the freedom to embellish, change, edit, whatever, her own work.
What is the difference or the dividing line between good and bad translation? I mean, I'm sure you've taken a look at a book that's been translated in, let's say, English to Spanish or vice versa, and thought, this is not a good translation. Why would you come to that conclusion? Or what is the difference between good and bad translation?
I read a lot of translations with my ear as a translator. And in fact, I was just reading, going back to a 19th century, early 20th century Italian novel, The Leopard. And it read beautifully, and only every once in a while, we were reading it aloud, I stumbled. And I thought, oh, here is something wrong. I don't know. It's just you have to have your ear really, really finely attuned. You have to read visualizing. Does this work? Do I understand what this is?
What if there's not a word in the other language for it?
What?
What if there's not a word in the other language for it? So you're translating, and it's kind of like, here's this English word, let's say, then there's no equivalent in another language.
Oh, that happens.
Does that just not happen?
That happens all the time.
It does. Okay. What do you do in instances like that?
In fact, there's a famous lecture called by Ortega y Gasset about the misery and the splendor of translation. And the misery is that translation is impossible. And the splendor is that translation is impossible. Because every time, you know, that you run into that all the time, that there is not a clear equivalent. So translation is the art of the possible, almost like politics, the art of the possible. You have to figure out the best way to do it. And of course, every different genre brings different challenges. The most challenging of all is poetry, because you have to determine how do you do rhyme and meaning and rhythm and all that in a different language. And it's really, really exciting and challenging.
Wow. So the English language obviously has, there's so many synonyms in the English language. There's just so many choices that are at the disposal of somebody writing in English. Is that a positive or a negative when you're translating English into another language? And are other languages just as rich as English in terms of just the volume of options?
Well,
sorry, I asked you a compound question there, but maybe you can take it one at a time.
Yeah. I am kind of an unusual translator in that I don't translate mostly into my native language. Translating into Spanish presents any number of problems. To begin with, which Spanish are you translating into? Which from which country? Because the language really varies dramatically from one country to another, especially the daily language, not the higher level, more sophisticated language, but the daily level language, for instance, the language of food varies entirely. The language of vegetation and trees and gardening varies. So you have to, the daily language, the colloquial language varies dramatically. So you have to figure out which language, which Spanish are you going to translate into? And then I don't translate into Spanish because even though my Spanish is very good, it is not, I don't live in Spanish. And so I don't have a control of the daily Spanish, of the street Spanish. Do you know what I mean? Does this make sense?
I do. Yeah. So it's almost like dialects, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, for instance, I didn't really understand, even though I'm Italian, I remember reading Elena Ferrante's books, and she was talking about they started speaking in Italian. I'm thinking, well, what is she talking about? They're in Italy, but they were speaking in dialects, and then they would go to like proper Italian in certain places. So I didn't really understand what she meant until I had gotten deeper into the book. So yeah, there's these dialects that you have to take into account that, that's got to be really difficult then or complex.
Well, I mean, you have to know if you're going to be published in Mexico, you use Mexican expressions. If you're going to be published in Argentina, it's a whole other game. In fact, I translated a book from Argentina, which was you were talking about the relationship between the writer and the translator. And there were a bunch of expressions that I had not heard, I was not familiar with. And so the author was very, very helpful. But this was a very intense experience in that this book was semi-autobiographical or mostly autobiographical and about her experience of being one of the disappeared in Argentina. If you know what disappeared are, they're the people that the government imprisoned and without any record or any word or any protections from the law at all. And she survived. And her brother was also disappeared and did not survive. And so this was a very... this was not just a book. This was just not a story. This was her life I was translating. And she had to approve every single word in that book. She helped me a lot with the expressions that I didn't know, but it was just an intense experience. I think that's when I decided maybe the next time I'll translate a dead author.
Yeah. Now, what languages do you translate into, from and into?
Oh, no, I translate, different texts, medical texts or commercial texts or even legal texts I can translate into Spanish. But literature I translate only into English.
Talk about your approach to translation. I mean, do you have a philosophical approach or a mechanistic approach that you can articulate?
Yeah, you have to eventually figure out what you want to do with this text, how you want to approach it. I am of the school that wants to take the reader to the culture rather than domesticate the foreign culture and bring it to the States. I want to bring the reader to the foreign culture. I think that's part of the purpose of reading foreign literature, right? To mm-hmm. kind of experience that. And so for that reason, I tend to sometimes leave the syntax in the original language, or leave a lot of words, sprinkle words that I leave in the text in the original language. And that is being done more and more and more. I mean, Latino writers in the States are writing, including a lot of Spanglish or Spanish in their texts. So my purpose is initially to bring the reader to the text. And then there's the whole question of what you have to be faithful to the original, right? But what does that mean? How faithful do you have to be? You cannot translate word by word. If you translate word by word, you end up with a gibberish called translationese in the profession. You have to translate by sentences, and you have to take into account the rhythm and the impact that this text wants to have on the reader. And you have to take into account what is important. To give you a very small example, there's a text in Spanish entitled Tres Tristes Tigres, and by a Cuban writer, Guillermo Cabrera Infante. Now, titles are really interesting because they have to, you know, they have to have a little punch, right? Tres Tristes Tigres. And how do you translate that? The literal translation is Three Sad Tigers, okay? Mm-hmm. But is that the point of Tres Tristes Tigres? No, it's the sound. And so the translator, who is one of my heroes, her name is Suzanne Dulevine, and she undertook all the untranslatable texts that there are. Those were for her. She decided to translate it Three Trapped Tigers, because she did, her decision was that the important thing was the sound. So the title in English is Three Trapped Tigers.
Got it. And rhythm is so important to writing. So yeah, if the rhythm gets thrown off, then the writing is lost. The quality of the writing ends up getting lost, maybe even the pacing. So what
you were talking about the wealth of the English language, and it's true. English is so rich, but we always find ways to express everything else, thanks to thesauruses, right? Mm-hmm. One of the problems with English, however, when you're translating into Spanish, is not the wealth of words, but the problem with little words. English has so many one-syllable words, and when you go to look for a rhythm of a sentence, it really, you stumble upon a wonderfully rich and nuanced Spanish sentence that ends up being completely chopped and machine gun like in English because of these little words.
Yeah, it goes from flow to staccato.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Now, there are examples, I believe, of books that actually didn't do all that well in the United States in English and got translated into another language and was a sensation in another country. Then there's also, and he comes to mind because I was just in Big Sur this past weekend, Henry Miller,
right?
Who lived in Big Sur for part of his life, at least. Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn. It was too risque, too racy, too sexual for American tastes at the time. And that book ended up being translated into French, and I think the French liked it. I think the Brits, of course, the Brits would read it in English. that there are times when there's other cultures who appreciate a book more than the original version of it in English. And here in the United States, is there not? I can't think of an example of something that has just exploded overseas that didn't do quite as well here, but I know there's examples.
I know there are two, and offhand I cannot think of any one of them, since I usually work the other way. I usually work by bringing things into English from other cultures that I like, books that I love, books that I wish I had written.
And then you have, you know, Elena Ferrante, an Italian writer whose books work all over the world. I mean, huge sellers. And who is the guy who wrote the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Right.
He's from Norway?
Scandinavian writer. His name escapes me, but it's Scandinavian.
I think he's from Scandinavian, yeah. And he was a ridiculous figure, like selling a book every 5 seconds all over the world. So there are, I mean, what do you think about that? I guess there's just stories or a way of telling stories that just transcends cultures. I mean, transcends might not be the right word, but they apply to every culture. They work in every culture.
Right, right. That is precisely what the Embassy of Spain and the Ministry of Culture is trying to gauge when they parcel out these books to critics and say, please tell me which ones we should invest in that would work.
Hmm.
It is just really interesting. I have to tell you one of my favorite examples of how cultures have to be translated. Something as simple as the English expression, we're very close. When two people, to express the relationship between two friends, we are very close. It's expressed in a spatial way, right? Closeness. Whereas how would you say that in German? In German, you say wir verstehen uns, which is we understand each other. It's a cerebral. It's expressed in cerebral terms.
How many languages do you speak, Christina?
No, I speak very well only two, but I dabble into a lot of others. But let me finish with this. Then you go to Spanish, and in Spanish, to say exactly the same, to mean exactly the same thing, you would say somos íntimos, whereas that word íntimos communicates a physical or an emotional. So you see how the three cultures express it. It's the same thing, but they express it in different terms. And if you translate somos íntimos into English, we're intimate, you're saying something completely different.
Exactly. Exactly. I like how go ahead. Finish that thought.
And that is why cognates are such a hurdle. I always, whenever I look at a translation, I always check for different cognates to make sure that they're correct, because they're very treacherous cognates. Some simple ones like embarrassed is not embarazada in Spanish. Embarazada in Spanish is pregnant. So you cannot quite trust the cognates. And for example, ambitious in English, you write a recommendation letter and you say somebody is really ambitious. That is very positive. This person, that what the connotations are, that this person is hardworking and, you know, team worker and all that. Whereas in Spanish, ambicioso is a red flag. It means that this person can, you know, will do anything to get ahead, stab you in the back, etc. So it's really, really so much more than just, I mean, it just a dictionary doesn't work to translate. You have to know the connotations. You have to know, like with people, words are polysemic and have different meanings, are behave differently around other words. If you say, for example, duck, without any context, you have no idea whether you're talking about the bird or it's the verb, lower your head, because you're going to get shot at.
Right.
So
right.
Do you see how it begins to get complicated and complex?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like how your bio says that you've been translating words and cultures since you came to the United States. Because getting again back to Elena Ferrante, an example of from reading that, it really conveyed the culture in Italy, and not in a positive way for men. I have to say, Italian men do not come off well in Elena Ferrante novels, and not all the women do either. But the men are just deplorable. Of course, she is writing about certain areas of Italy that are not, are sometimes uncultured and poor parts of Italy. But I was trying to think of another example. But one of the great things about reading is the ability to be transported to a place. To certainly, good writing will transport you to a situation, to a relationship, to a vignette, but to be able to be transported to another place entirely, another country, another culture is really a fabulous thing. What else can you tell us about translation that we should know? What am I overlooking here, Christina? What are some of the other elements to this that you think should be highlighted?
Well, going back to Elena Ferrante, have you seen the latest film, the Lost Daughter?
The Lost Daughter, yes. I'll watch anything with Olivia Colman, number one. And it wasn't until the end that my wife and I saw that it was an Elena Ferrante story. And then it was like, oh, this makes perfect sense. That's her all the way. But go ahead. What point were you going to make?
The protagonist in the film and in the book is the translator herself. And do you know that in the film they use complete passages from the English translation, and they do not mention the name of the translator. Translators are, kind of orphans, the orphans of the whole process. But I think very slowly we're going to get more credit here, because translators are like musicians. I mean, musicians are playing with somebody else's score, true? Mm-hmm. And one does it in one way and one does it in another, and one takes 30 minutes and the other one takes 38 minutes to play a sonata. And it's all fine and good. Whereas, and the same with actors. Actors, that's an intersemiotic translation. Actors are translating the words of someone to three-dimensional and life situations, and they get credit for different performances. Why translators do not is just a prejudice that needs to be dispelled.
Yeah. There's so many instances in all of the arts where there's people behind the scene that are playing a critical role, and they don't really get the credit that they deserve. Now, do you sometimes get offered work and it's a novel that you're just not interested in? You think, that's going to bore me. Is translation the sort of thing that, obviously you love translation, do you take any work that you get, or are you particular about what you will take?
No. Since this is a side gig and a labor of love, I am very choosy in the work that I accept. It is a really intense relationship. To translate a novel can take a year or more. And you spend a lot of time with those characters, with those words, with that story. And if you don't like it, if I don't like it, I just can't do it.
So you're given a deadline. I mean, they expect you to get it translated in a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. But is that fairly typical that they give the translator a year to go ahead and turn the product around?
Yeah. It's not unusual for it to be a year. Yeah.
And who's involved with you? In other words, how many other people are communicating with you? Is it strictly a person at the publishing house, or do you also engage with the author? Who's involved?
It varies. It depends. I have done translations where I worked strictly with the author. I have done translations where there was another reader involved, and that made it kind of complicated and difficult. I would much rather just work with the author, and in fact, I would much rather just work with a publishing house and their editor. So it varies. The situation varies with each case, the ones that I have done.
Now, you're a voracious reader, so just sticking with English language novels, the writing that you see out there, there's obviously a lot of just, pop novels. And then there's, literary novels and so on. Give us your assessment. Give us your critique of the quality of the writing. What's getting published? Maybe what isn't getting published? Obviously there's a lot of good writers out there who never get published. What's your criticism of American literature right now?
Oh dear, that is a big, big question. And I have to say that I'm not sure that I'm really able to answer that question right now, because my reading, preferences have changed so much. These days, I read for beautiful sentences somehow. I don't so much care about the story. I don't so much care about the characters or the development. I read if the writer can give me a beautiful sentence, I'm just elated for the day.
Oh, bless you, Christina. I read the same way.
Really?
I'm the same. Yeah, there's books that I'll read and I'll tell my wife, Valerie, you should read this. I don't do that anymore because she says, this isn't really going anywhere. I mean, there's no real story here. And it's kind of like, but look at the characters, look at the scenes, listen to that language.
Exactly. Yeah.
But most people don't read that way. Those are not the books that sell. Exactly. But that's exactly what I look for. I look for the phrasing. I look for characters. I want dialogue that doesn't sound like real people. That's something really something extra there. I hate it when I hear writing coaches or people who are trying to turn out the next novelist say, write dialogue like people really talk. If you listen to people talk, it's boring. It is boring. You have to have something a little otherworldly about the conversation. There needs to be something that is really compelling about it. And I will say also, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I tend to not like novels that are just besotted with dialogue. I like an author to take the wheel and drive that story and then season it with some dialogue, not just soak it in dialogue.
Exactly. Yeah. And when translating, actually, dialogue for me is the hardest. I'm much better at description and narration, etc.
Where, is it because of colloquialisms that the dialogue becomes so difficult?
Yeah. For example, the first novel that I did, I eventually made it a collaboration with a colleague because there were several chapters that were about drug usage and the language of addicts, and I just felt helpless somehow to get it right. I mean, I knew I could get a version of it, but to get it right, I just couldn't do it. I had to do quite a bit of research and how to and ask for help and how to do that, how to get those drug addicts talking to make them sound real. I find it quite challenging because you have to. I mean, every character if the author does it has to speak differently, right? So you have to. When you begin translating, the first chapter is the hardest because you have to kind of get into the author's head and get into his rhythm and his level of language and his tone. And when there's a lot of dialogue and different people talking, that has to be done over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our guest has been Christina De La Torre from Paris to Atlanta to now Washington, D.C., which is her home. She's a world traveler, by the way. Christina, you and Erdman have been all over the world. Where's your next destination, by the way?
Morocco.
Oh, I see. Bogey. I see. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Casablanca. Have you been?
I have not been to Casablanca, but I want to. That's on my list. It's on my list.
Well, we should meet there. Again, it's time for another encounter.
Exactly. You know, I'm hoping that it's just going to be serendipitous like the last time that Lone is like, whoa, we're in the same boutique hotel in some, exquisite foreign land, and it happens all over again. Christina is, was a professor in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at Emory University. If you don't know Emory University, it is considered the Ivy League of the Southeast, very esteemed university. Her husband, Erdman, taught there as well. Christina, this has been very interesting. It's always good to spend time with you. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. And I hope we have a cheerleader for translators now.
Absolutely.